Okay, let's get into this. When you think about truly monumental American geology, your mind usually goes to the big names, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Grand Canyon, the Rockies, the big explosive volcanoes of the
Sure,
Cascades.
classics.
But there is this massive, almost hidden giant sitting right there in the Pacific Northwest, a geographic feature so vast that its creation literally rewrote the map of three entire states. And what's more, it holds the key to understanding why one of our most famous national parks is, well, so volatile today.
That is the perfect way to put it. It's a paradox. And that's what we're diving into today, the Columbia Plateau.
Right.
And our mission for you, listening, is to get past just the surface geography, the wheat fields, the high desert, and really understand that this whole region is, in essence, one enormous solidified snapshot of deep Earth history.
A snapshot, I like that.
Yeah, and we're going to trace its surprising and incredibly violent creation. We'll get into the physics of how 6,000 feet of solid rock piled up. And then we'll reveal its direct, undeniable, and frankly astonishing connection to the geysers and bubbling springs of Yellowstone.
And that connection, that link between a flat, high desert in Washington and the famous thermal features of Yellowstone, that's the real aha moment.
That's the one. It ties everything together.
But before we get there, we really have to establish the sheer scale of this thing. I mean, it's almost impossible to comprehend. This isn't just a patch of high ground.
No, not at all. It's an immense geologic and geographic region. It spans huge portions of Washington, Oregon, and Idaho.
And its location is key,
Oh,
right?
it sits right in the middle, sandwiched between the Cascade Range to the west, which is a classic volcanic arc on a plate boundary, and then the Rocky Mountains to the east.
So it's inland, way inland.
Exactly. And that central inland location is what makes its very existence such a profound geological puzzle to begin with.
And its fundamental identity, we have to define this. It's a wide flood basalt plateau
Right.
cut through by the Columbia River. And we should probably sit with that term flood basalt for a second because it tells you exactly what this region is not.
Yes. It is the absolute antithesis of the classic volcano image. You picture Mount Rainier, Mount Hood. You see a central vent, a peak, that classic cone shape.
A mountain.
A mountain, exactly. Flood basalts are totally different. This means the entire region wasn't formed by slow, gentle plate movement or even, a singular explosive eruption. It was formed by fissures.
Fissures. It just cracks in the ground.
Long, massive cracks in the Earth's crust that just opened up and unleashed this overwhelming, sustained outpouring of superheated liquid rock that literally flowed across the landscape like water.
An outpouring is the right word. And when we talk about the size of the area this affected, it really redefines the word massive.
It does. The plateau covers the geologic region we call the Columbia River Basalt Group.
And the scale of that.
Well, this is the initial shock factor, always. The lava flows literally engulfed about 63,000 square miles.
Wow.
That's 160,000 square kilometers of the Pacific Northwest.
Okay, put that in perspective for me. 63,000 square miles is.
It's roughly the size of the entire state of Georgia, or a bit larger than England and Wales combined.
And the important thing, the so what here, is that this land didn't rise up slowly like mountains do.
Not at all. It wasn't crustal deformation. It was violently and geologically speaking, very quickly inundated by liquid rock. It's one of the largest such events ever documented on the planet. It's what we call a large igneous province.
LIP.
A LIP, exactly.
So we've got the enormous scale of the where. Now let's dig into the when and the how. This wasn't just a one and done event, was it?
Not even close. It was a process that spanned deep, deep time. The time frame puts us mostly in the late Miocene and early Pliocene epochs.
So we're talking, what, around 17 to 6 million years ago?
Roughly, yes. We're looking at a continuous, relentless eruption cycle that happened over a span of maybe 10 to 15 million years.
I mean, in human terms, that's an eternity, but geologically?
Geologically, that is a remarkably short period for this much material to be extruded. It really wasn't a slow leak, it was a sustained gusher.
10 to 15 million years of these huge fissure eruptions just flowing over the landscape, one layer on top of the next. It's hard to visualize that much sustained activity.
And remember, the lava wasn't coming from a single point like a volcano. It was coming from these immense fissure systems. Imagine cracks in the earth that are tens, maybe even hundreds of miles long, just pouring out this very low viscosity, incredibly liquid basalt lava.
Low viscosity meaning it's really runny.
Super runny. It could travel massive distances before it finally cooled and hardened so it didn't pile up in a cone.
Right. It spread out like pancake batter on a giant griddle.
That's a great analogy. It spread out and covered pretty much everything. And the cumulative effect of all those flows is just staggering. If you were to drill down today, the final thickness of all that solidified lava reaches a maximum of more than 6,000 feet.
6,000 feet, that's over a mile deep.
Over a mile of solid rock, and that's 1.8 kilometers. In some of the deepest parts of the basin, geologists think it could be closer to 10,000 feet.
10,000 feet deep. Okay, to give you another analogy, if you took the Willis Tower in Chicago, the Sears Tower, which is over 1,400 feet tall, you'd have to stack four, maybe five of them on top of each other just to reach the depth of the rock foundation under parts of Washington and Oregon.
That really drives it home, doesn't it?
It's not a feature on the landscape. It is the landscape. It's the foundation.
Exactly. And this is where it gets really interesting, because we move from just one simple massive flow to a highly complex, readable geological record.
You mean it's not just one big block of rock?
Not at all. Because the eruptions happened episodically over millions of years, it created this meticulously structured record. It's made up of seven major formations.
So like layers in a cake. And these formations, I assume they tell a story. They're not just about different ages, but maybe different chemistries, different eruption styles.
You've got it. The sequencing gives us the precise history of how this this heat source behaved as the continent moved over it. These are the layers geologists use to date and correlate rock across the entire region.
Okay, so let's walk through them. What are these seven layers?
All right, so generally from the oldest and deepest layer up to the youngest and shallowest. Number one is the Steens basalt.
Steens.
This is often considered the initial, the first big outpouring. These flows are critical because they represent the very first moment that plume of hot rock reached the base of the lithosphere.
And where do you find those?
Mostly in southern Oregon.
Yeah.
And their sheer volume points to an immediate dramatic start to all this activity. It's like the initial crack in the continental crust.
Okay, what's next?
After that, we have the Imnaha basalt. It's named for flows you can see near the Imnaha River. And it represents a subsequent major pulse of volcanism. You can tell it apart from the Steens flows by slightly different chemical signatures.
So geologists can fingerprint these different layers.
They can. And that brings us to number three, which is really the main event, the Grande Ronde basalt.
Grande Ronde. That one sounds important.
Oh, it is. The Grande Ronde basalt is the single largest volume of basalt in the entire group. It accounts for an estimated 85% of the total rock volume.
85% in one formation.
85%. Huh. This formation alone is thought to have poured out over just a few million years, which points to a period of just unimaginable heat and productivity from the mantle plume below.
Wow. Okay, so that's the big one. What follows that?
Then you get the picture of Gorge Basalt. You find this more in central Oregon, and it shows that even while the massive Grande Ronde flows were happening, there were other localized, chemically distinct eruptions going on.
So multiple fissures were active.
Right. Then there's the Prineville basalt, another layer named for a location in Oregon. Then number six is the Wanapum basalt. These flows are spread broadly across the plateau, and they often have distinct physical features, which give geologists really critical visual markers when they're mapping.
And the final one, the top layer.
And finally, number seven, the Saddle Mountains basalt. These are generally some of the younger flows. You find them at the very top of the stack. And what's really cool is they're sometimes interbedded with sediments.
Sediments, like from rivers or lakes.
Exactly. And those sediments give us clues about what the climate was like right before the volcanism finally started to die down.
Let's go back to the Grande Ronde for a second. If that one formation is 85% of the entire volume, what does that tell you about the plume underneath? Was it just like an initial super gush that then tapered off?
That's a great question. And yes, that is absolutely the interpretation. The enormous volume of the Grande Ronde suggests that when the plume had, you can think of it as this vast mushroom-shaped top of the mantle plume, when it first slammed into the cold, rigid North American plate, the melting was just instantaneous and incredibly productive. It's like opening a massive valve all at once.
So that first deluge just created the bulk of that 6,000-foot-thick stack.
In a nutshell, yes. It quickly covered thousands of square miles. The flows that came after it, like the Wanapum and Saddle Mountains, were still massive by any normal standard, but they represented the activity tapering off, or maybe the heat source shifting as the plate moved.
So it goes from being a geological catastrophe to a complex layered history book.
A very, very thick history book. And remember, even these seven major formations are broken down even further by geologists into formal, informal members, and literally hundreds, if not thousands, of individual flows.
Every single flow representing its own eruption event?
Its own moment in time. It means for about 10 million years, the Pacific Northwest was just continually being repaved by molten rock.
Okay, so that structure is now clear. 6,000 feet deep, 63,000 square miles, seven major layers, all dominated by that incredible Grand Ronde basalt. But now we have to talk about the immediate mechanical consequence of all this. You're pouring trillions of tons of new rock onto the surface. How did the Earth's crust even handle that?
This is where we get into the mechanism of subsidence. And it's a bit counterintuitive, but it's a fascinating trade-off driven by mass displacement.
A trade-off. Okay.
Think about it. As that huge volume of molten rock, the magma, came to the surface, it didn't just appear out of nowhere. It came from the mantle below.
Right. It had to leave a space behind.
It left a relative void. This rapid evacuation of material from beneath the lithosphere created a space. So instead of the surface being pushed up, which is what happens when mountains form.
The opposite happened.
The very movement of mass from deep underground to the surface meant the crust above had its foundational support literally pulled out from under it.
And at the same time, you've got the incredible weight of the new basalt flows pushing down.
Precisely. That tremendous load, combined with the evacuation of the material underneath, caused the Earth's crust to gradually sink into the space left by the rising lava.
So the plateau is actually a depression.
It is. It's a large, slightly depressed lava plateau. It created this broad basin. The plateau is literally a depression because of the sheer volume and weight of its own creation. It's a wonderful piece of geological irony.
Which means the center of the Columbia Plateau is actually a bit lower in elevation than the mountain ranges around it, even though it's covered by miles of rock.
That's exactly right. It defined the entire regional topography. Now, this massive event didn't happen in a vacuum. It was interacting, often violently, with the geography that was already there.
And nothing would have been more affected than the biggest feature of all the ancient Columbia River.
Absolutely. The river was directly confronted by these northwesterly advancing lava flows. Remember, this basalt was incredibly liquid. It moved fast.
So it didn't just go around the river valley.
It didn't care about the river valley. The flow was so overwhelming, it just poured right into the existing stream valleys, filling them up completely. This often forced the river to just stop flowing for a while or scramble to find entirely new channels.
It's the ultimate geological obstruction. Just imagine a river valley and then a mile-thick layer of liquid rock pouring across it.
You can imagine the steam, the explosions as the water flashed to vapor. But that filling action wasn't just destructive, it was also critically constructive.
How so?
Well, when the lava finally hardened, often creating those huge, distinctive columnar basalt patterns you can see today, it formed natural dams.
Oh, of course.
Dams hundreds of feet high. And these natural dams backed up the water, causing these massive impoundments. They created temporary, but often really extensive lakes all across the landscape.
So the flow had this incredible two-sided power. It didn't just pave over old land, it forcibly rerouted one of the continent's major water systems.
And the current course of the Columbia River, especially where it cuts through the gorge, is largely a result of the river being repeatedly blocked and then forced into new, deeper channels by the relentless movement of that lava. It had to carve its way through some of the hardest rock imaginable.
And you mentioned those temporary lakes. It's in those impoundment sites, right? The ones created by the hardened basalt dams, that we find something almost paradoxical.
It is. We find one of the most exciting parts of the plateau's formation, the paleontological fossil record.
I just find this transition phenomenal. You have this massive, destructive volcanic event that, by complete chance, creates the perfect conditions for preserving the tiny details of the life it was displacing.
It's all about the conditions. When you have a calm, deep, still body of water, like a lake, and you have fine sediment-like volcanic ash or silt building up very quickly.
You get a low-oxygen environment.
You get an anaerobic, low-energy environment. It's a perfect laboratory for preservation. The lake beds became these incredible time capsules entombed between layers of hardened basalt.
So what are we actually finding in these Miocene-era lake beds?
The detail is just astonishing. We find beautiful, incredibly detailed fossil leaf impressions.
From what kinds of trees?
We're talking about capturing the whole flora of the Miocene. Sycamores, oaks, other trees that tell us the climate was much warmer and wetter than the semi-arid plateau we know today. These leaves would just settle to the bottom, get trapped in fine silt, and then instantly get covered by the next eruption's fine ash or the next flood's sediment, perfectly preserved.
So you can literally reconstruct the ancient forests that were there right before or even during the eruption cycles.
That's the goal. We also find vast quantities of petrified wood, sometimes in logs, hundreds of feet long, which speaks to just how extensive these ancient forests were.
And what about smaller things?
Critically, we find exquisitely preserved fossil insects. They're tiny, but they are crucial data points for understanding the precise temperature and ecology of the Miocene era.
Insects, wow. And larger life. Did any animals get preserved?
Yes, and this is perhaps the most compelling part. The bones of vertebrate animals. Researchers have uncovered remains of large mammals, including ancient rhinos, horses, even early camels, which were once abundant in North America.
So the remains got trapped in the lake mud.
Trapped in the soft mud, quickly buried, and then sealed off by the surrounding basalt. It gives us this amazing window into the fauna of the Northwest before it became a 6,000-foot deep slab of rock. The destruction literally created the preservation.
That is just remarkable, moving from the scale of a planetary upheaval to the microscopic detail of an ancient insect wing. But now we have to get back to the central, most challenging puzzle here.
The big one.
Everything we've talked about, the volume, the scale, the 10-million-year time frame, it all points to a process that should be happening at a plate boundary where the crust is being stretched or subducted. But the Columbia Plateau is far inland.
Hundreds of miles from the Pacific plate boundary.
So how could an area so far from a plate boundary experience such an enormous outpouring of lava?
That is the core geological question. It challenged scientists for decades. Tectonic theory, as it was first understood, just didn't have a clean answer for this kind of massive inland volcanism.
It required thinking outside the box, or rather outside the movement of the plates themselves. The evidence was clearly suggesting some kind of concentrated non-traditional heat source was melting rock right at the base of the lithosphere.
It had to be concentrated and it had to be persistent. So the detective work began. What is feeding this giant furnace and why is its influence visible across such a vast linear distance?
And to solve this, scientists undertook this incredible feat of geological detective work, right? Using radiometric dating.
Sophisticated radiometric dating techniques. They established precise hardening dates for thousands of individual lava flows and volcanic rocks across the entire Pacific Northwest. They weren't just looking at the big picture anymore. They were looking for a pattern, a trail of evidence.
And what they found was the ultimate clue.
It was a temporal-spatial correlation that links this inland flow to the biggest thermal anomaly in North America today.
So walk us through that key discovery. What was the pattern?
The key finding was just startlingly elegant. When they mapped out all the ages of the rocks, the youngest volcanic rocks, the most recently active ones, they were all clustered right near the Yellowstone Plateau in the east.
Okay.
Conversely, the farther west they went, back into the massive flood basalts of Washington and Oregon.
The older the lavas were.
The older and older they got. This wasn't a random scattering. It was a perfect linear timeline, a continuous chronological track stretching nearly 500 miles across the continent.
The rocks were essentially dating themselves, creating a perfect geological breadcrumb trail.
Exactly. The entire Columbia Plateau was revealed to be the older, solidified part of a continuous ongoing event that is currently culminating in the intense activity we see at Yellowstone today.
And this unmistakable pattern led directly to the dominant theory.
The most probable explanation, the deep mantle plume, or hot spot theory. This theory says that an extremely hot plume of deep mantle material is rising all the way to the surface right beneath the Columbia Plateau province.
Now, we've heard this theory applied elsewhere. Hawaii is the classic example.
Hawaii, Iceland, they're the prime examples. Massive volcanic systems that are nowhere near a major plate boundary.
Mm-hmm.
But let's talk about the physics here because it's immense. Where is this heat coming from?
Right. What's the source?
The source is at the deepest layer of the Earth we can really access. The concentrated heat originates from a temperature instability that develops, well, for reasons we don't fully understand, but it's at the boundary between the Earth's core and its mantle.
The core-mantle boundary. How deep is that?
It's roughly 2,900 kilometers or 1,800 miles beneath our feet. This is the deepest, most sustained furnace we can conceptualize.
That is truly mind-boggling depth. we are talking about a heat source that originates almost halfway to the center of the Earth.
Precisely. And this tremendous heat triggers a plume, a buoyant column of superheated rock that could be hundreds of kilometers in diameter. Because it's hotter and less dense than the rock around it, it just ascends directly up through the mantle.
All the way to the base of our tectonic plate.
All the way. And when it hits the bottom of that cold, rigid continental plate, it causes massive decompression melting, which then erupts as the flood basalt we've been talking about.
And here it is, the core revolutionary concept that connects the entire story. The mechanism that allows this to happen in the middle of a continent is that the hot spot itself, that deep mantle plume, is stationary.
It's anchored deep below the crust, completely indifferent to what's happening on the surface.
Correct. So the elegance of this theory is its simplicity. The North American plate is moving over it.
Yes. Think of the hotspot as a stationary, high-intensity industrial torch, just anchored deep inside the Earth.
And the North American continent is this immense conveyor belt just passing slowly over the flame.
That's the perfect analogy. The hotspot burns a long, sequential track onto the bottom of the plate.
So those massive 6,000-foot deep flows we talked about in Washington and Oregon, they're just the old scars.
They are the ancient scarring left by that initial powerful thermal event. They were created when that part of the North American plate was sitting directly over the most intense part of the heat source 10 to 15 million years ago.
And as the plate continued its steady journey to the northeast,
it carried the solidified Columbia basalts with it away from the heat source.
And today, millions of years later, the North American plate is positioned so that the hot spot is now sitting directly beneath the Yellowstone National Park region.
That's the whole story. The track starts in the far west with the oldest flows, the Steens and Grand Ronde forming the vast basalt plateau, and it just sweeps up to the Yellowstone Plateau, which is the current location of the youngest, most powerful volcanic activity.
So the whole thing provides this superb record of the rate and direction of plate motion. It's a geological tape measure stamped right onto the continent.
It is the ultimate aha moment. The Columbia Plateau isn't just a place, it's a history book recording our continent's physical journey across the globe.
But just to be thorough, while this hotspot theory is widely accepted, are there any credible counterarguments? For the listener who follows this stuff, it's important to acknowledge where the scientific debate is.
That's a crucial point. While the deep plume model is dominant because it just so elegantly explains the linearity and the sheer scale of it all, some geologists have proposed alternatives.
Okay, like what?
Often involving shallower mantle processes. For instance, some models suggest that maybe the initial rifting and extension caused by the Cascades subduction zone far to the west might have allowed a more passive upwelling of the mantle.
Which would mean you wouldn't need a deep, core-anchored plume. The heat source would be a result of the plate itself ripping apart and letting the ambient heat escape.
Exactly. But the problem with that is the timing of the eruptions, the incredible volume, and that clear chronological track leading directly to Yellowstone. At the end of the day, the evidence is just overwhelming in favor of a fixed, deep heat source. The deep plume theory is by far the strongest candidate.
And of course, the modern visible evidence of this active process is just impossible to miss if you go to Yellowstone.
Oh, absolutely. Yellowstone, with its iconic geysers like Old Faithful, the mud pots, the steaming fumaroles, it provides all the visible evidence you could ever want of the concentration of heat right beneath the surface where that hot spot currently resides.
All that bubbling, all that heat, it's the current manifestation of the exact same mantle plume that caused the Grand Ronde basalts to erupt millions of years ago.
It's the current active and highly visible end of that 63,000 square mile trail of ancient lava.
It really makes you look at the entire topography of the Pacific Northwest completely differently. You go from seeing a flat, high desert region to recognizing it as this giant solidified wound left by a planetary heating element moving beneath the continent.
A wound is a good word for it.
So let's move from that deep time geology to the world we actually live in. We need to ground this enormous geological formation in our modern reality. We need to connect the 6,000 feet of basalt to the ecology, the resources, and the human communities that live on its surface today.
Right. And that transition is fascinating because the geology really does dictate the biology. The plateau's surface terrain is globally classified by ecologists as the Columbia Plateau ecoregion.
And what category does that fall into?
It sits within a massive global category. The Nearctic temperate and subtropical grasslands, savannas, and shrublands ecoregion.
So even though the foundation is volcanic rock, The environment itself is defined by being dry, by aridity.
Yes, and that aridity is also a result of the geology, isn't it? The sheer height of the Cascade Range to the west creates a monumental rain shadow.
Oh, of course. The Cascades block all the moist air coming off the Pacific.
Exactly. And that leaves the inland plateau dry and semi-arid. But the basalt foundation defines more than just the climate. It defines the soil.
Right, because the plateau is famous for its agriculture, but you can't be planting wheat directly into 10-million-year-old basalt.
You certainly cannot. So how does that deep, hard rock layer support the famous agriculture of the region? The wheat fields around Pullman, the potato fields in the Tri-Cities.
That must be what's on top of the basalt.
It is. The critical link is Laga soil. After the basalts cooled and were covered by ice age sediments, massive continental winds blew fine glacial silt that's Laos from the now dry lake beds and river floodplains.
So wind-blown soil.
Exactly. This silt settled on top of the basalt, often accumulating into these thick, fertile, wind-blown drifts that are incredibly rich in minerals and deep enough to sustain massive crops. The basalt is just the solid, waterproof container for that rich soil.
So the 6,000 feet of basalt is the container in the base, and the fertile top layer, the loess, is the result of post-volcanic glacial processes, a two-stage process.
And that foundation dictates the soil, the hydrology, and fundamentally how communities developed. It's helpful for you listening to realize that so many major population centers of the inland Northwest are literally built right on top of this dense feature, relying on its characteristics for survival.
Let's make this tangible. Let's use that list of specific cities we compiled. Looking at Washington, the cities on the plateau really show the diversity of the region, but they're all tied together by that basalt foundation.
Absolutely. In the eastern half of the state, you have a major urban center like Spokane, which sits on the northern fringe where the basalt meets glacial deposits. You got Yakima, known for its fruit and hops, which relies on irrigation from the plateau's resources.
And then there are the Tri-Cities Pasco, Kennewick, and Richland, a crucial point where the Snake and Columbia rivers meet, where the hydrology is entirely controlled by those deep basalt layers.
And don't forget the agricultural and university towns. Moses Lake, Pullman, which is famous for the Palouse Hills covered in that thick loess. Walla Walla, a famous wine region whose soil is heavily influenced by the basalt. Then Ellensburg, Colfax, Goldendale, the list goes on.
And if we move south into Oregon?
It's a direct extension of that same basaltic landscape. You find Pendleton, famous for its wheat, Hermiston, Hood River, where the Columbia River Gorge cuts deep into the basalt, the Dalles, Athena, and Milton Freewater.
And finally, extending into Idaho, the plateau's influence is clear there too.
It is. Coeur d'Alene, though it's nestled near the Rockies, it sits adjacent to the basalt flows. You have Lewiston, which is situated in a deep lava-carved canyon at the confluence of the Snake and Clearwater rivers, and Moscow, home to the University of Idaho, sitting on those same rich Palouse lower soils as Pullman.
The takeaway here is that when you drive between any of these cities, you're not just crossing flat land.
You are driving over an ancient, complex, 6,000-foot-deep history book. The land might look flat or gently rolling, but that rolling topography is just the surface of what is essentially an enormous, solidified, oceanic-style crust sitting hundreds of miles inland.
And the existence of this massive block of hard rock has created several other related regional features, especially how water has tried to, well, destroy and then utilize the work of the lava.
Indeed. And the first related feature is absolutely crucial. It's the antithesis of the smooth lava flow. The channeled scablands.
Scablands. These are intricately carved, often bare rock channels and deep gorges, right?
Etched into the basalt surface by catastrophic glacial meltwater floods, specifically the Missoula floods.
So this must have been an incredible battle between ice and fire, geologically speaking. The basalt was the immovable object, and the Missoula floods were the unstoppable force.
That's a perfect way to put it. And the floods happened long after the basalt had cooled. The sheer hardness and thickness of the basalt provided its formidable canvas. So when the gigantic ice dams broke, unleashing volumes of water equal to all the world's current rivers combined, the water couldn't easily penetrate the basalt. Instead, it just stripped away the lowest soil on top and carved those huge, stark, channelized landscapes right into the solid rock below. The scablands exist because the underlying rock was so unbelievably hard.
So the plateau provided the hard canvas, and the ice age floods were the geological chisel.
Exactly. And that leads directly to the Grand Coulee, one of the most famous features of the scablands. This is a massive ancient riverbed carved deep into the basalt by those same floodwaters. It's an enormous trench, hundreds of feet deep and miles wide.
which now defines the irrigation and water systems for the whole region, including the Grand Coulee Dam.
The very same. And finally, beneath all of this hard rock that resisted erosion, we find the one resource that sustains all those cities and farms, the Columbia Plateau Aquifer System.
This connects perfectly back to the layering you were talking about earlier.
It does. Water can't flow through solid rock.
Yeah.
But it can flow through fractures, joints, and critically, between the separate layers of those seven basalt formations. The way the water interacts with the cooling fractures and the sedimentary layers within the basalt determines the availability of groundwater for everyone.
So the basalt is both the container and the filter for the water,
making it directly linked to modern human survival and agriculture.
So we have a region forged by internal heat from the Earth's core, solidified into a deep layered structure, then sculpted by massive ice age floods, and now sustaining civilization through the water trapped within its own solidified layers.
It's a geological legacy that is complex far beyond what you just see on the surface.
Which brings us to our final moment. We've covered the ground, literally and figuratively. Let's do a quick deep dive summary.
Okay. We established the staggering scale. The Columbia Plateau is a vast, large igneous province covering 63,000 square miles. It's built from multiple formations, like the dominant Grand Ronde Basalt, reaching a depth of more than 6,000 feet, all piled up over a rapid 10 to 15 million years.
We detailed the mechanics. The incredible weight of the lava caused the crust to subside, creating that depressed plateau, and it simultaneously rerouted the mighty Columbia River. And those resulting lava dams created temporary lakes that acted as perfect time capsules, preserving invaluable fossil records.
And we reveal the scientific astonishment that this massive volcanism happened far from a plate boundary, because the plateau is the historical track left by the North American plate moving over a stationary deep earth hotspot, which is currently centered right beneath Yellowstone National Park.
The entire basalt field is astonishingly a physical tape measure, documenting the rate and direction of continental drift.
That's the core of it.
So we understand the past, and we understand the present activity in Yellowstone. But what does this all mean for the future? We always like to end with something to mull over, a final provocative thought.
Well, if we accept the evidence that the mantle plume is stationary anchored near the core mantle boundary, and that the North American plate is moving over it at a measurable clip, then the concentration of heat currently visible as the spectacular geysers and fumaroles of Yellowstone National Park is actively migrating away from its current location.
It's not a question of if the activity will cease in the Yellowstone region, but when.
Exactly. The current dramatic thermal activity will eventually wane and die out as the North American plate slides off that stationary plume, just as the land that is now the Columbia Plateau flowed past it 10 million years ago.
So the history of the plateau isn't just a record of the past.
It's a clear prediction of the future. The hotspot will inevitably begin to affect new regions farther to the east or northeast. If this geological process continues on its current trajectory, the question isn't whether the geological record will continue to be written, but what part of the continent will be next to experience the surface expression of that immense, unmoving furnace thousands of miles below.
Will we see new flood basalts erupting in, say, Montana? Or maybe even farther east, millions of years from now, starting the entire process all over again? The legacy of heat continues to write its story across the continent, reminding us that no landscape, no matter how settled, is truly fixed in time.